Hi, everybody. Ben Starr with you here with The Positive Mind, bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. And of course, as always, I'm joined by Kevin O'Donohue of the DeMille Center here on West 57th Street in Manhattan. Hey, Kevin, how was your weekend?
Fantastic.
Glad to hear it.
The weather is great.
You know, Kevin, we've talked a lot on this show in the past about mindfulness and meditation, and it's a subject that we revisit from time to time.
Great.
And we thought, you know, today would be, why not, a good time to revisit that, and not only revisit that, but have a conversation with someone who's really, really, really done a lot of work around this subject, around research, around educating, and around helping us understand what it's all about. So today we've decided to invite as our guest onto the program Dr. Ronald Alexander, also known as Dr. Ron. He's a psychotherapist based in Santa Monica, California, clinical trainer, a licensed marriage and family therapist. He's also the director of the Open Mind Training Institute in Santa Monica, an organization that offers personal and professional training programs in integrative mind-body therapies. Dr. Ron has taught at UCLA, Pepperdine University. He's conducted all kinds of seminars all around the world, and this weekend he's going to be right here in the city at the Open Center. Dr. Ron, thank you so much for being able to join us today. We appreciate your time.
Oh, you're very welcome. It's a pleasure to be with both of you.
Thanks, Ron. Good to have you. So we have a lot to cover. I read your book over the weekend, and it brought up back a lot of concepts that I've been practicing and other people who listen to The Positive Mind practicing. Are you going to be doing meditations at your workshop?
Yes. On Saturday, between 10 and 5:30 at the New York Open Center, I'll be doing a variety of mindfulness meditations, guided meditations that come from positive psychology, and then some meditations from both Tibetan and the non-dual philosophical schools.
So what if somebody's not familiar with meditation? Is that going to be an obstacle for them to participate?
No, usually people attend at both the beginner, the intermediate, and the advanced level. And so what I always do at every workshop or training is start out with the fundamentals and then build from the fundamentals towards the intermediate practice, and then towards the end of the day, leave everybody with some more advanced skills and meditational approaches.
I just want to point out that the New York Open Center has generously made a special offer for WBAI listeners to get a discount on this Saturday's session with Dr. Ron, and we'll tell you a little bit more about that. Stay tuned for that, because we'd love everyone to have the opportunity to go and check out some of these guided meditations that are going to be happening.
And it's going to be a great workshop, because even if you're new to meditation, you've never done it before, you can see clearly, even by the midday break, that meditation is accessible to you. You're going to be able to meditate and learn how to meditate in this workshop. But this workshop is also going to have a focus. Ron, you talk about the usefulness of meditation in times of crisis. The name of your book is Wise Mind, Open Mind, Finding Purpose and Meaning in Times of Crisis. Are you going to talk about some crises, situations that people have used meditation on?
Yes. Yes. I've had the unique opportunity throughout my 44-year career to work with people, for example, Vietnam veterans, people who were involved in 9/11, car accidents, victims of various forms of abuse. One of the most essential tools that really helps people to recover from trauma, as well as to be guided through times of crisis and loss, and we're always in these enormous waves of change each and every day now, and with the rise of terrorism, and as well as the frequency of violence, domestic violence inside of our own country, that we really need, more importantly than any other time I think in history, precise tools that the Buddha was one of the very first teachers of. Mindfulness meditation, it's a path. And what's most important about it is that it's a pathway, rather than, you don't even have to be a Buddhist to practice Buddhist mindfulness meditation.
Yeah, sure.
After the Buddha experienced his realization and his awakening, one of the very first discourses that he gave is he went to this beautiful park outside this village in Sarnath, India. At that time in history, it was referred to as the ancient kingdom of Ayodhya. It's in the north central part of India, and it's about 45 minutes from the place where the Buddha underwent his awakening, which is called Bodh Gaya.
Okay. And
today, there's the Mahabodhi Garden Temple, which I went to, and what the Buddha taught is his very first discourse, and I think it's really, really important, is he gave a sutra, and it was in the Deer Park, and it was the sutra on mindfulness and on the importance of meditating.
And what does, you know, you mentioned something about the birth of the observer in your book, and almost like it's a second self. Now, for veteran meditators, they know what this means. When you're meditating, you this birth almost of somebody watching your thoughts and emotions. But can you tell us about what the concept means to you?
Yes, and it's a very, very important construct in that when we're meditating, we have a conscious self. We have what is referred to as everyday mind. Yeah. And that's the part of the self that navigates, gets up, brushes their teeth, not really thinking about it, makes coffee.
And it's talking to you all day long.
Talking all day long to us.
Yeah.
And oftentimes, most of what it's saying, unfortunately, is just what's called the mind's chatter or monkey mind.
And often it's negative stuff, too.
That's a very good point.
Yeah.
It's saying you're a bad person, you should feel guilty, you should feel shame, it's criticizing you, you're not enough, no matter what you do, you'll never be enough. And we call that in Western psychology having an overdeveloped harsh superego.
Right.
So that's a fancy word for having
a vicious critic inside your head.
Yes, and it's a vicious critic that's kind of nonstop. It's always talking. And most of the time it's talking, as you just mentioned, to us.
You know, I heard this interesting statistic that when people interact, 7 out of 10 comments are negative comments. So, you know, it makes a lot of sense. If you're walking around with a critic's voice in your own head, that when you meet up with people, you can't just turn it off.
Yes, and that's a really wonderful point, because in my book, Wise Mind, Open Mind, I tell a story where I was brought in to a recording company, major music studio. And I was asked to sit strategically, intervene with them to help assist them in their marketing and advertising campaign.
Yeah.
And so I sat there with a yellow pad, and I said to them, you know, just go ahead, do your thing, and I'll just listen. And so I wrote down, and in the course of about 50 minutes, the word no had been used 66 times. And the word yes had only been used 11 times.
Wow, yeah.
So I stopped them, and I shared the data, because, you know, exactly. Being raised a scientist, you got to show people data,
yeah.
Right? And everybody laughed. I mean, they just couldn't believe it, because what people were doing in old-school organizational development speak is what they were doing is called fire hosing.
Right.
Where somebody has an idea and you pour cold water on it.
Yeah. I see you do couples counseling. It reminds me of a time when I had a gentleman coming in for private sessions, and he was complaining about his wife all the time. And I said, okay, why don't you bring her in? Just bring her in, and we'll do sessions together, and we'll see what happens. After about the fourth session, I had him turn on his tape recorder. And I said, let's tape the session. I won't tape it. You tape it so you can use it at home. Well, he taped their dinner conversation, and he came in the next week, and he says, you know what? I'm the problem.
Yeah. That was a fantastic idea, Kevin.
Yeah. Well, it couldn't be helped. I mean, when somebody's saying no and you and it's their fault all the time, they're not hearing it. You know, they're not hearing themselves do it. But when they hear it on the tape and then they hear the other person, they realize, well, maybe I have something wrong here.
Dr. Ron, I want to ask you about some common objections or common perceived obstacles to meditation. What about people who say things like, well, maybe meditating might conflict with my existing religious beliefs, or, you know, I'm simply too busy or active to learn how to relax and quiet my mind and do this. Or maybe that it will cut down on my drive and my creativity. What do you say to people with those kinds of responses to meditation?
Well, Ben, those are really, really good questions. And, you know, myth number one is many people fear that if they practice mindfulness or they practice any form of meditation, that somehow they'll lose their drive or their ambition. And then especially, I've worked in the entertainment industry here in Hollywood for 44 years. And in the old days, people used to not only say no to medication, but people that were manic or hypomanic or manic depressive, they would really fight me on applying or practicing meditation, let alone any form of medication, say like lithium.
Sure.
And because the fear in the popular kind of subcultural speak was, well, you'll lose your hypomanic or your mania.
Your fire, right? The creative energy.
Your productivity.
Right. Yeah. Yes. And what we've come to discover, especially with mindfulness, is, well, one myth is that somehow if you are of any other religious persuasion, it will interfere with your spiritual or religious beliefs. And that's a misnomer, because the way that we've brought mindfulness from the East to the West, and not only myself, but I would say probably Jon Kabat-Zinn is probably done the best job of really extracting the Buddhist element, filtering it, and just teaching the bare bones mindfulness-based stress reduction, which has allowed people of, you know, all faiths to participate in learning how to meditate and not being put at odds with their own spiritual or religious beliefs. For example, it's very common, and I'll get into a story of a couple later that I helped through an enormous crisis. And they were both Catholics, and they were afraid that if they practiced mindfulness in some way, they would be at odds with their religion. So, you know, that's myth number one. Right. And it's just a myth. The other thing is that there's a fear that if I meditate, and as Ben, you said, it'll take the fire, it'll take my mojo, it'll somehow lessen the intensity of my ambition, my ideals, my creative fire, and or my creativity itself. And one of the beautiful things we've been able to discover in the last 40 years is that what mindfulness really does is it helps you to fine-tune that creativity. And so, for example, many people who are manic or hypomanic or have these huge creative surges, oftentimes they'll fill pages and pages and pages of their notebooks. And then when they come down from the mania, it'll take them hours and hours and hours to sift through that. Maybe there's like 3, 4, 5 pearls in all that writing. And when people like this are open and available and make available to themselves the willingness to learn to meditate, is what they do is over time, all that sympathetic nervous system drive and what, you know, we might refer to as a dorsal vagal center drive in the nervous system, all that fire starts to become refined and smooth and almost like sandpapered or in a laser-like way, so that the pure gold of creativity, the real core elements, can be gleaned from that kind of drive. And then if I cycle back to that question about the witnessing awareness.
Yeah, yeah.
What we've come to discover is that the antidote, and I write a lot in my book about the importance of cultivating what are called positive or wholesome antidotes to any kind of pain, affliction.
Yeah, it's, I have to just say, it's a great contribution in the book. You have probably 15 meditations in there that are really like antidotes to negative states of mind. You do a nice one on restlessness, the art of comfort, or the soft meditation, the soft comfort meditation. You don't have to go into those, but for those of you who are going to go to the workshop and buy the book, it has really, which is really a good part of positive psychology. You know, positive psychology is an antidote to negative tapes that we keep running in our head. And these meditations are wonderful in that aspect.
You're tuned into WBAI. It's The Positive Mind. We're speaking with Dr. Ron Alexander. He's a psychotherapist based in California who's going to be here this weekend to do a workshop at the Open Center called Mind, Mood, and Happiness, Transforming the Self. And we're discussing mindfulness and meditation today on The Positive Mind, a subject that we've touched on in the past. We thought we'd revisit it today. We've gotten the Open Center to offer a discount to WBAI listeners, which we'll tell you about coming up at the break. So stay tuned for that.
Okay.
One thing we know about a reason that people tend to avoid therapy is because they may be afraid of what they find out about themselves. It's another, you know, it's one thing we know from research yep. that a lot of addiction, a lot of substance addiction comes from trying to silence the noise in the head. What I wonder is, are there people who are worried for the same reason, worried that maybe meditation will quiet them down to the point where they find out something that they're scared to learn?
Yes. Yeah. It's a very good question, Ben. Oftentimes people are afraid of slowing down. And what the number one fear is if they slow down, they will either discover something, let's say like something repressed or suppressed or some old trauma, or they'll drop into some level of pain or discomfort in what we call in Buddhist psychology some quality of afflictive mind or afflictive mood or afflictive body state.
So what do you tell those people?
The most important thing is that meditation fundamentally helps you to develop a user-friendly relationship with your creative unconscious, and that your creative unconscious is always up to something interesting. Your creative unconscious wants only what is the best and good for you in terms of guidance and protection, safety and comfort, and that your creative unconscious understands the importance of the cultivation of safety and comfort.
Terrific. So it really is, there is an antidote in there to the negativity by tapping into the unconscious. People do not need to fear what comes up during meditation, because during meditation, people generally tap into the creative unconscious. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. And so that people, what they're afraid of is that they're going to tap into the old school unconscious, which is that the old understanding of the mind was that the unconscious, from Freud's tripartite model of id, ego, superego, was that your unconscious mind, or what we call in meditational understanding, is the inside. You know, when you go inside and you go inside to explore. Well, unfortunately, Freud developed an entire understanding of the mind that there were demons and there was destructive impulses towards sex and aggression and, you know, death.
Death, yeah.
And it's no longer really relevant, is it,
at
this point?
No. I mean, this.
Well, that's completely, it's so archaic, you know, it's kind of like an old AT&T bell phone on the wall.
But meditation, people's perception of what meditation is also sort of stuck back in the old days of somebody sitting and meditating all day and living a totally different life, a beggar or whatever. And that's not what the current meditator is really doing today.
Yeah, that's a really good point, Kevin, because people have the old view that somebody that's a meditator has to kind of become an ascetic, or they have to dress a certain way, or they spend most of their time meditating or in contemplation or prayer, or they have to go up, you know, to some ashram in the mountains or off to India.
Yeah.
And I think with the development of the internet and technology, most of the people that I teach to meditate anywhere between 12 minutes and 20 minutes. And then people who have a lot of time on the weekend, I'll say, well, why don't you meditate for 30 minutes or 45 minutes?
Right.
One thing I want to know, Ron, is, and you touched on this earlier, we're living in really tumultuous times, really dark and violent times, and I think everyone is feeling it. Just the level of suffering, of violence, of tragedy that's out there, and it seems like every single week there's a new tragedy, there's a new just violent reality that we're living in, and I think it's taxing on many people, mentally and emotionally. And I wonder how people can use this, can use meditation as a tool to not only deal with that, but, you know, transform their own lives and maybe in doing so, transform society at large.
And Ben, that's an excellent point, because all of the tragedy that we see almost daily and the terrorist bombings and even the violence within inside of the United States from a domestic perspective, is what it does is, in understanding from a meditational perspective, the effect on the nervous system, and from another perspective that's called somatic experiencing, is that we're either in fight, flight, or freeze our nervous system activity, those three modes. And being deluged daily with, really, they ought to call it the bad news nightly, there's so much bad news and there's so much fear that people's nervous systems are becoming locked into what is called sympathetic activity, which is to fight or take flight. And meditation, especially mindfulness meditation, is exceptionally helpful and useful at turning offline the sympathetic activity, which is staying frozen, being in fight or flight.
The survival instinct, right?
Yes, the survival instinct. And turning online the parasympathetic so that you switch from survival into a state of relaxation, of comfort, of safety. And the parasympathetic activity that mindfulness meditation takes us into also takes us into a more socially engaged nervous system, so that we want to look at people's eyes, we want to make eye contact, and that creates more positive attachment and positive bonding and attunement. And more than any time in history, we really do need positive attachment to feel that we're supported by other people, that we can seek comfort and shelter and safety, and have a sense of interbeing. That's the great Vietnamese Buddhist master Thich Nhat Hanh has coined that frame, the importance of interbeing and sharing everything that we've gone through together.
And as you get better at meditating, you get a faster access to the parasympathetic nervous system. Would you say that's kind of true? To me, it's always like a faucet of warm water. You know you're in it. You know when you're in your fight or flight. And as you get good at observing, you know, your negative tapes and, you know, I'd say probably the early stages of meditating, you really see all the negative stuff. And then as you get better, you get past that much quicker. Is that true?
Yes, it is true. When I first got into meditation, I was a nice Irish Catholic boy.
You too.
Studying. Yep, me too. From Boston.
Okay.
And the only things I had heard or read about meditation were from the Beatles and Mahesh Yogi and the Moody Blues. And I had never experienced meditation. And then I arrived in Amherst in 1970 in the fall. And for the first couple of weeks at school at the University of Massachusetts, I experienced, and I didn't even know what it was, but I couldn't sleep. My palms were sweating all the time. My heart was palpitating. I'd go to class, and I just had this dread, this unbelievable sense of dread and angst.
Right.
So I went to the student health services, And this young woman said to me, she looked at my intake app and she said, well, I could send you to a psychiatrist who's 75 and he could give you medication, or I could give you this young psychologist who's 28 and he's just come back from 2 years on a Fulbright fellowship to Southeast Asia in India, where he's been studying yoga and meditation. And the type of meditation he's been studying is Vipassana, which is mindfulness meditation.
Right.
So she said, which of the two would you like? And at that time I went, wow, free drugs or meditation? don't know what to do. But anyways, I opted for the meditation.
Not the medication. Okay.
That's right.
All right.
And he suggested, you know, every week we would go in and we'd sit on the floor on pillows instead of on a couch and right. him sitting in his chair. And we would talk for like 20 or 30 minutes, and then he'd say, in the last 20 or 30 minutes, we're going to meditate together. And what I want you to do is just go home to, and I was living in a farmhouse on Main Street in Amherst at the time. He said, just take 5 minutes. But don't try to meditate any longer than 5 minutes.
Great.
And that one intervention was so helpful because, of course, when 5 minutes came up, I wanted to sit 20 minutes,
right, right.
then 50 minutes.
It's
and
dangerous, isn't it? I mean, you can really develop a taste for meditating once you get started.
You really can, because, as you said earlier, the more frequently you practice, the easier it gets, and it turns on and boots up your parasympathetic nervous system so that you get this wonderful, like, warm water waves of, like, warm spring air blowing in your face through your nervous system. You get the sense of this is comforting, this is deeply relaxing, it's de-stressing.
You are tuned into The Positive Mind here on 99.5 FM WBAI New York. We're going to be taking a short musical break here. You've been hearing Dr. Ron Alexander here in the studio with me and Kevin O'Donohue. I'm Ben Starr. We wanted to share with you some great information regarding Dr. Ron's workshop that's going to be happening this weekend at the New York Open Center. And the New York Open Center has generously allowed all of our WBAI and Positive Mind listeners a $30 discount on that workshop that's coming up this weekend. So if you're interested in that discount, you can call 212-219-2527, extension 2. That's 212-219-2527, extension number 2. Tell them you heard Dr. Ron here on The Positive Mind. They'll give you a $30 discount to the workshop, which is taking place this Saturday, July 16th, from 10 in the morning to 5:30 in the afternoon. One more time, the number to call is 212-219-2527, extension 2. It's going to be a great workshop, 7 hours, on how to be mindful, how to meditate, how to incorporate that into your everyday life. And we're excited to be able to provide that discount to our listeners. And we thank the New York Open Center for making that possible. So it's coming up on half past the hour. We're going to take a short musical break, and we'll be back after this with more from Dr. Ron Alexander.
Let's go for a ride on with the stereo. Get lost in the night. I've been waiting to show you how to run.
Here on WBAI with Drive. Maybe you're driving in your car this summer afternoon. Maybe you're checking us out here online, on the radio. It is The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM. We're speaking with Dr. Ronald Alexander, who's going to be here this weekend at the New York Open Institute, the Open Center. He's a very interesting man who's agreed to join us here today. He's taught at UCLA. He's taught at the Omega Institute. He's taught at Pepperdine University. He's given workshops all over the world. Again, Dr. Ron Alexander. Dr. Ron, thank you again for being here, for joining us. Tell us a little bit more. Tell us, Kevin, you wanted to ask a question.
Yeah, Ron, you mentioned in the book, you know, people don't know how accessible meditation is to them. You talk about a gentleman in a museum looking at a painting. You remember that?
Yes. That gentleman is the extraordinary stage, television, and film actor Richard Chamberlain. Many people remember as Dr. Kildare and then Shogun.
Yeah, you didn't mention that in the book, but
no, I didn't. But it's a fair game to share it on radio.
Sure.
He's a yogi. He's a meditator. I've met him several times just in public situations. I don't know any kind of professional capacity.
But it did strike me that what he was really doing standing in front of that painting was like a meditation. He
yes.
let it come to him.
Yes. Very well said. There was a room at the Los Angeles County Art Museum, and it was a David Hockney exhibit. And it was a Friday afternoon, and there were not a lot of people there. And myself and a couple of colleagues, we approached the room, and he was the only person in the room, and he was standing like in reverent awe with his arms stretched out like an angel,
yeah,
as far as he could.
Right.
And we slowly approached about 30 feet back, and we could actually hear him breathing. And then I moved over to an angle, and I could see he had his eyes wide open, and he was breathing kind of in a meditative yogic way. And it became clear to me it was what he was doing is that he not only was he in a meditation, but he was drinking it in. He was ingesting
right.
the art. Yeah. And that's what artists do, too, is that they frequently go and listen to other people's music, or they go to art museums, and they nurture. They nurture their own soul. They nurture their own creative unconscious through the process of meditative absorbing.
Yeah.
And then there's one other last thing. I just wanted to make sure that your listeners got the distinction when we were talking about the critical mind is counterbalancing it with, you asked about the notion of the witnessing awareness.
Yes.
And what we scientifically we call that is the metacognitive part of the of our own mind that has a viewing, an observing, a noting, and a listening capacity. It's actually a part of a brain function in the form of having another level, a metacognitive
sure.
level. You know, that's an awareness of a awareness.
Right. And I always tell people, if they don't think they have access to it, just remember you putting on your socks this morning. What color socks are you wearing?
Yes.
You know, and to deepen that, to take it further back, to pull yourself back. And now can you see yourself sitting in the chair? Step
yes.
back and be above yourself in the chair, you know.
So, yes.
So this becomes available when you meditate. And I imagine Richard Chamberlain has gotten so adept at it that he can walk out his front door and receive in whatever way and in whatever time he wants to.
Yes, you walk out your front door and you're already in the meta-awareness. You're already looking at the blue sky, hearing the birds, and hearing the distinction in birds, not just hearing birds, yeah. but hearing the different types of birds.
Right.
And you're getting in your car, and there's that awareness of, I'm getting in my car, so I need to be alert, and I need to be super aware, right. so not just be talking on my phone while I'm driving. I need to be driving.
Yeah. So, Ron, we have so much more to cover. I want to jump around a little bit. You talk about three stages, and I really think that the letting go stage is so critical in becoming a meditator and learning how to meditate. You talk about letting go, tuning in, and then moving forward. But to me, can you say something about resistance?
Yes. Resistance is really important because in Buddhist psychology, we understand resistance as a hindrance.
Okay.
And in Western positive psychology, we see the things that we resist, we often also have a persistent component to them.
Right.
And we oftentimes resist them because they're the very experiences or the very emotions or the very new thoughts or new beliefs that we need to entertain. And what I write about in my book is that we oftentimes resist what is good for us because we're afraid that if we let go, we're going to be letting go into what we don't know.
Right.
And what most of us constantly struggle with is the comfort zone is staying, whether you're in a wholesome, positive experience or neutral, kind of vanilla everyday experience, or painful, negative, afflictive experience. Most people gravitate and get frozen around that which is painful. Yeah. Or creates discomfort. And you're either holding on, and most often we're holding on to the present and we're holding on to the past because of its familiarity, or and there's a quality of grasping to that, right, which is a Buddhist psychological term, grasping, clinging, or we're in some state of aversion, where we're pushing away unwanted experience. And sometimes we're pushing away unwanted experience because we're afraid it's going to be painful.
I love the example you gave in the book of a couple that lost their two young children in a car accident, and that you were working with them, and that they felt guilt, which, you know, is a very interesting thing what the mind can come up with in order to hang on. But it occurred to me that they didn't want to give up the loss of their kids. So they kept themselves feeling guilty about it.
Yes. And the guilt, the quality of the guilt, it had both a punishing aspect, because even though they had nothing to do with the children's death, they lost both of their children.
The guilt was surviving the children, right?
Yes, it was.
And the guilt was getting yourself happy again. How can we be happy ever again if our two children died? Kind of boiled down to that thought, I thought.
Yes, well said. And the guilt became what I would call an afflictive companion. So post the loss of the children, so they had this new companion of guilt, and they were both absolutely, with abject terror, afraid that if they let go of the guilt of what their life was going to be like post the loss and death of their two children. And so one of the things I suggested that they do was, in every session, we started to practice mindfulness meditation. And I also sent them to India, and they spent some time, and they worked with Mother Teresa. Wow. And when, yeah.
What I loved about that was that, you know, you used the word immersion in their grief.
Yeah.
And to me, meditation often is an immersion.
A deep immersion.
Yeah.
So it took them deeply into their grief. And when they were working with all of the people that were dying, whether they were infants or children or adolescents or middle-aged people or elderly people at the center in Calcutta with Mother Teresa, they experienced a washing away, because I suggested that no matter what Mother Teresa had them do, that they go, they start their day with mindfulness and they finish their day with mindfulness. And so one night they were out sitting and meditating at the riverbank after a very, very long 14-hour day in the clinic with Mother Teresa. And the wife went into the mindfulness meditation, and she reached over and she put her hand on the husband's heart. And the husband, 16 months after the children had died, he had become frozen. He really couldn't emotionally get access to how he was feeling. He was just absolutely frozen with grief and guilt. And she put her hand on his heart chakra, and he started to naturally and very slowly, like just the beginning of rain, he started crying. And then she was looking at the waves, and she noticed that the waves first started very gentle up against the riverbank, and then they became more and more increasingly larger and larger, and his tears moved into deep sobbing, deep, deep grief. And they both had this profound experience where, as they were using mindfulness meditation, the mindfulness meditation, just like the waves were touching the shore 6 feet from them, it was washing away the guilt.
Right.
And the resistance, you know, holding on, that because our two children died in a terrible car crash, we cannot ever experience any pleasure or happiness or ecstasy or joy.
No.
We must feel guilty. They experienced it washing away and shifting.
Yeah.
And they came back, and I saw them a couple of months later in my office, and they said, we've had extraordinary moments in the other parts of India that we went to, whether we were looking at the sacred sculptures or various temples that we visited. We had experiences of joy and ecstasy and happiness. And we were absolutely blown away that we could be free of that guilt.
I want to ask you a little bit more about that resistance that you talk about, Dr. Ron, because I think it is completely natural. I think that for most of us, we seek the path of least resistance. For most of us, change is a scary thing because we're used to our lives being a certain way, a certain status quo.
And even if they're miserable.
Even if it's miserable, and any sort of change or shakeup is going to create a period of chaos that we're afraid of, and so I think short term, that resistance is almost serving our needs in a short term way, even if it in the long term does not serve us. So my question, I guess, would be, how do people overcome that resistance, right? And how do people once they've moved past the avoidance of the difficult emotions, what are the benefits, the long-term benefits, the payoffs?
Well,
I have to say, a cheaper therapy bill.
Yeah.
People who start to meditate can often, you know, shortcut their therapy quite a lot.
That's right. There's less need.
But you take it from there, Ron.
Yeah, what are the payoffs?
Well, one payoff is there's a theorem that was it comes from Zen, the great Zen master Dogen Zen Zai, and one of the theorists and trainers in Gestalt therapy in the 60s and 70s, Arnold Beiser, a psychiatrist, an MD, who was also interested in meditation because he was crippled with a very severe an autoimmune and neurological disease. He was one of my mentors. He coined a phrase and then wrote a short chapter on it called The Paradoxical Theory of Change. And the paradoxical theory of change goes like this. Change occurs not when we try to become what we are not, but when we accept what we are. So change occurs not when we try to become what we are not, but when we accept what and where we are. And so one of the benefits or payoffs of having resistance is that resistance is a spiritual teacher. It's like a lamppost. Wherever we're resisting, it means that we're holding on. We're grasping, we're clinging, or we're trying to push away something. And the antidote, of course, in Buddhist psychology to holding on is to explore. You know, holding on is contraction, both at the level of mind, but it's also contraction at the level of neuromuscular cellular coordination, is that we hold back our feelings,
right.
We hold in our emotions, we hold in our pain. And the antidote to that, of course, is letting go. And when you think about the word let go, well, you know, let go into your guilt, or let go into your joy, or let go into your sadness, or let go into your pleasure, is letting go. It has an expansive in both a here and now opening, but it also has a future orientation, so that when we let go and we go through our resistances, often what we find out is one of the wonderful payoffs to resistance is everything that's positive and wholesome on the other side.
You know, and it's great when people can put it into a phrase, what their resistance is. I know, like, breakthroughs in therapy finally come when the client says, oh, now I see what I've been resisting. So in meditation, you get to sit with your own thoughts, watch the pattern of your thinking, and slowly come to an awareness of what you're resisting. Is that true?
Yeah, and we call that having either the first mini satori, where there's aha,
right,
I'm seeing something for the very first time, Aldous Huxley,
right,
and both Aldous Huxley and William Blake often referred to William Blake's phrase as if that when we have an aha, we have a mini satori, it's as if we're seeing through the same eyes that Adam and Eve,
right,
metaphor,
yeah,
must have seen,
yeah,
on that very first day of creation.
Yeah.
The very first day in the Garden of Eden.
You know, I couldn't help but thinking when reading how this work that you've done and put together here is really an advancement on cognitive behavioral therapy. Because in cognitive behavioral, you're taught also to look at your thoughts, label them, know what they are, and sort of reduce your anxiety by taking control of them. But it seems to me that meditation is really a whole body experience, and that cognitive behavioral isn't. And that in this sense, it's kind of an advancement on that.
It is. And fortunately, for the cognitive behavioral therapists, you know, I don't identify myself as exclusively as a cognitive behavioral therapist because my training is more in mind and body, in Ericksonian hypnosis, in
right.
Gestalt therapy,
right.
In somatic experiencing therapy, which are more in the human potential movement, the positive psychological approaches. But cognitive behavioral therapy is a wonderful tool because they have been researching it for over a 20-year period, and somewhere along the road, some of the theorists began to go to Buddhist meditational retreats, and then they adapted the mindfulness approach and then wedded it with cognitive behavioral therapy. So now we have a lot of outcome research, not only on cognitive behavioral therapy, but on the effectiveness of how mindfulness is super helpful at helping you to change your thoughts and to transform negative thoughts into positive thoughts.
Fantastic. And I'm just going to say to people, listeners, that in the book, there are many, many, many examples. And they're not pie-in-the-sky kind of examples on how to transform negative states of mind. These are very, very practical guided meditations to really transform being stuck and helping you to let go. So we're going to recommend the book and the workshop here. Again, the name of the book is Wise Mind, Open Mind, and I want to talk to you, Brown, about what open mind means.
In Buddhism, in classical thinking, is what is called wise mind. And wise mind is that state of consciousness that one arrives at where there's a cultivation of early stage wisdom and early stage awakening.
Okay.
And then the second category of mind, which again is a stage of consciousness rather than a state of consciousness, is what's called big mind. In big mind, probably for the listeners, can most easily be understood by evoking Carl Jung, the famous Swiss psychologist, who stumbled upon in the 1900s when he was a student of Freud in Vienna. He came up with this notion that not only do we have a personal unconscious, but we have a collective unconscious, and that uniquely all of our collective unconscious is interconnected to everyone else's, not only in the United States or in Europe, but even Aborigines sometimes dream of like the cross, or the Aborigines dream of myths and symbols that somebody in Switzerland dreams about.
Right.
And so the Buddhist came upon this, you know, obviously thousands of years ago, when the Buddha was teaching.
We have 2 minutes, so
okay,
get us to open mind.
All right. So wise mind, big mind, no mind, obviously, is that you get to a place where you drop all awareness of cognitive, conscious, and unconscious mind.
Right.
And you're in the emptiness of the self. Open mind is, I had the unique opportunity to join U2 in 1993 in Dublin when they were doing the Zooropa tour. Mm. And the lead guitarist, Edge, through an informal meeting with his girlfriend, who's his wife at the time, I mean wife now, we were sitting and talking in a pub after one of the shows about 2:30 in the morning, and he said, you know, all of the music and the tunes and melodies that for the Zooropa, the Achtung Baby album and the Zooropa album, you know, I was dreaming about them in different parts of the day from doing yoga. They were all coming to me. And he said, what are your thoughts about that? And I said, and just like a huge opening occurred inside of my own mind at the moment. And I said, well, I think you've tapped into what's called open mind. And I said, Mozart, Beethoven, all of the great philosophers, Aristotle, Plato, all the great painters.
So this is the first time you came up with the phrase open mind?
Yes, it was the very first time.
Okay.
And then I started to research it and have been working and researching it ever since with artists, filmmakers, writers, painters, musicians. And meditation will take you naturally into open mind if you set the intention. And it's very important to set an intention when you start to meditate, that you want the meditation to go in a particular direction. In the same way, if you're going to fly from here to Honolulu, you have to set the instrumentation on your 747.
Ron, we're going to have to follow up with you after the workshop. There's just way too much to talk about from the book and probably from the workshop also. This has been great.
It really has been, Kevin. Again, if you're interested in attending the workshop that Dr. Ron's going to be putting on at the Open Center this weekend, call 212-219-2527 extension 2. Tell them you heard the program on WBAI. They'll give you a $30 discount. That's 212-219-2527. And stay tuned for the Artsy Fartsy Show with Barika Edwards.
Is it getting better? Or do you feel the same? Will it make it easier on you now? You got someone to blame. You're saying one love, one life, when it's one need in the night. One love, we get to share it. Leaves you, baby, if you don't care for it. Did I disappoint you? Or leave a bad taste in your mouth? We get to carry each other.